You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Hervé Tullet.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com and subscribe to the show. No matter how you listen, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Pandora, Spotify, or YouTube, you can subscribe to the show and never miss an episode. I'd like to thank some sponsors today. Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Business Essentials for Authors is your business 101 guide for the publishing industry. Whether you've never published at all or are looking to take your professional career up a notch in an easy-to-read and conversational way, the book covers the five pillars of business. We look at all of this and more from a long-term strategic view, how to get the plan done, and the mindset to make it all work. Business Essentials for Writers: How to Make Money in an Ever-Changing Industry by James Nettles. Both Sides of the Law, the Casper Halliday NYPD series, book one by Nathan Roden. He shared his father's dream of becoming a detective. A prison sentence was not part of his plan. Casper Halliday's dream began to unravel 2 months before his 16th birthday. His father, Bobby, resigned from the NYPD after 15 years without an explanation. Casper's parents fought. Sirens closed in on their home from every direction. The sound that had always been a source of comfort now brought only humiliation. Bobby Halliday moved out. Casper's dream dissolved into a daily fight for survival. All he wanted now was to finish high school so he could ease his mother's burden. On his 17th birthday, in the throes of depression, Casper made a bad decision. That decision brought him face to face with one of the most dangerous men in the city. In Casper's world, there is laughter and there are tears. There's light and there's bitter darkness. There are improbable friends and unspeakable enemies. The Casper Halliday NYPD series launches with the most unlikely of beginnings. Read Both Sides of the Law today. The ebook edition includes a sneak peek of Ghost Man, book two in the series. For the Words is a unique writing motivator unlike anything I've seen. For the Words is an online writing platform which motivates writers of all backgrounds to increase their word count through gamification. Writing can be challenging, especially when you need to consistently produce a high output of words. By injecting a little fun into the routine and using daily rewards to promote a healthy writing habit, For the Words makes it easier to reach that word count. We're a community of bloggers, professional authors, college and high school students, research scientists, gamers, and first-time writers from all over the world. Come for the words, stay for the fun. Go to thewords.com. Writers, the internet is one of the best tools for research and creativity. It can also be one of the biggest hindrances to productivity, distracting you from doing the seat in the chair, hand on keyboard work. Rescue Time gives you an accurate picture of how you spend your time to help you become more productive every single day. Spot inefficiencies in your day and become better at managing your time. Create a goal like spending less than 1 hour per day on email to help you stay focused. Set an alarm to tell you when you spent more than 2 hours on Facebook. Try Rescue Time and use our special discount code for 30% off a Rescue Time premium account by going to rescuetime.com/authorstories. Let us help you rescue your time. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Hervé Toulet on the show with me. He is a phenomenal children's book author and one of the most creative authors that I've ever had the pleasure of talking with. Welcome to the show, Hervé.
Thank you. Thank you very much to welcome me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
It came by accident. So I would say the first idea that I wanted to write a book for children, it was because I was jumping from advertising to illustration, and by illustration, like the whole range of stuff we can do in illustration, I was thinking, okay, I can also try to do a book for children, but without any real purpose in my mind. But then it became obvious that in that field, in that activity, there was something I was completely into.
How long had you worked in illustration?
I worked maybe for 10 years in illustrations, means I was doing illustrations for magazines, and I was doing my own children books, no compromise at all. I mean, illustration, it's a compromise. You have to understand what the people want from you. But right. in my work as a children book author, I was really doing what I wanted to do. It was really a free space, a protected space from, compromise mainly.
Right. Well, that's a really great point, because when you work as an artist for hire, it's not always your vision. It's someone else's vision that you're helping to influence and helping to bring alive. But ultimately, it belongs to someone else in the end, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It belongs to the compromise. It belongs to the dialogue. And with the dialogue, you could find some people that are really interested. There's some people that can push you forward. Few people, but it could exist that some people say, I know you can do that, even if you haven't done it before. It happened to me sometimes. I think too rarely, but it happens. And you could progress with this compromise, and you progress in the way you learn how to communicate, because the main thing is you've got an idea and you communicate your idea. So how do you communicate it for somebody or for yourself? But at what point, there's only one real topic, which is how you communicate the idea you want to communicate to somebody.
Right. You're talking about getting to do the work that you wanted to do, that is purely your vision with no compromise. Do you feel like the time that you worked for other people and having to work within that compromise, do you think that gave you tools that help you in doing things that are solely your own now?
Oh, yes, definitely. And even, I told you my first memory of becoming an author, it came lately, because I think that when I was 18, then 20, when even 30, I mean, I was a bit lost. I didn't know what to do with my life. I didn't know what I would really love to do. And during that time, I learned by the others in communication, in advertising, and compromise is a way also to build up your, it was a way for me to build up my life in a way.
Sure, sure. What was it that first got you into illustration and visual arts?
So I think that, as I told you, I was lost at 18. I was lost maybe a little bit before too. And I think that I had the chance to have a great French teacher, teacher of the French language, and he brought me by chance too, because at the beginning of the year he said, "Is there every year there's somebody that is interested in surrealism?" And that year, I raised my arm up, and I was the guy. And by being chosen to do something and to discover at 17 years old the surrealism, to discover the revolt, to discover the diversity of expression, I discover, a trail, a line, something I follow, because I follow by sculpture, cinema, poetry, painting, and history too. And I think it was wonderful for me to be catched by these guys, the surrealists, when I was 17. So it's really something that happened to me. And also, I have to say that I wasn't really very good at talking. I think I wasn't able to put a lot of words together and creating a sentence and giving an idea or a debate or whatever. I don't think I was really good for that. And maybe I discovered by surrealism the visual communication too. I mean, yeah.
I think surrealism is really interesting, especially the intersection of that with children's literature that you do now, because so many children's stories are fantastical and kind of over the top. That to me, that seems like a perfectly natural thing for an artist to be into, is surrealism, and then go into children's literature, because there's so much of children's literature that is this surrealistic and kind of, you know, out there, and I think it appeals to kids because they have these unhindered imaginations where you know, as we grow older, we kind of become more stifled and more conservative, and kids can just let their imaginations go anywhere.
Absolutely. And there is also this playful time with surrealism, because they play with words. But they play with words, not like words that mean something. But they were doing this cadavre esquisse, where you put a word, then you put a word, then you put a verb, then you put an adjective, and it's become a sentence, but just by random. And the random part, the playful part, the joy, the way they jump everywhere, they are very provocative too. It's childish. It's childhood. It's amazing. It's amazing to discover that.
You said that speaking, communicating was not your strong suit, and that art appealed to you, in that way, because it gave you, an outlet for expression. Do you feel like your work in visual art then helped your verbal communication?
Now I have to say that I know what I'm doing. I know why I'm doing what I'm doing. I understand who I am. So now I feel completely confident, because I've been doing interviews, because I wrote myself. So now I've got this, I know that I'm mostly a visual communicator. I know that the words came lately in my work when I'm doing a book. The words are the latest things that are coming. I know they must be precise, because I have to communicate the game I want to play with the reader. So now it's completely different. I think since probably 10 years, I'm more an adult in my work, an adult means I'm somebody who know, even if I always try to go forward and to progress in my work, but I know what I'm doing. So it's completely different now.
Right.
Yeah.
You said that when you first set out to do this project for yourself, and it was a children's book. What was that first idea that you had that became that children's book?
So there's something that I think I can do that, and it's very, very, it's a very strange situation. But I think that with my first book, I can explain all my books. There is all my books in my first book, and my first page and my first illustration of the first book is a guy who've got glasses, sunglasses. So the sunglasses, as it was very bad to draw, I draw two dots and they were black. And I say, this is Bernard, and you turn the page and there is a question, which is, what happened to him? So there is a double dialogue. This is Bernard. What happened to him? So it elicits a way to read, because there's already at the beginning two voices. And then, so there's one black hole because there's holes. And you turn the page and you understand that he had sunglasses with two holes, with two dots, black dots, because he had a knock on one eye. So two dots, one hole, and a dialogue in between the reader and the child, and a game, and a visual game. And that's my first idea, my first drawing of my first book. And all of that book is about that. So I think that I didn't understand what I was doing when I've been doing my first book. I was doing a book, but then I look at the book that was living by people reading it. It was not very successful, but I understood that there was this possibility of game, of dialogue. And I understand perfectly at the first book, even if I was shy to do a second one, a third one, at this time I wanted to keep my ideas for myself. But I understood that there was something here. And what was here? It was on the book. It was on the story. It was a dialogue in between an adult and a child with a book. And the game of turning the page with an adult and a child, and this play, this dialogue, this way to let them play together through the book, it came here. And it was very basic colors, very bad drawings, which is also something that come regularly in my work, not drawing, to give just simple tools as dots, as scribble or whatever, but very simple, but link with an idea. And all this is already in my first book. So, yeah, I don't know.
One thing that I love about your books is that, and I have children, and we've had tons and tons of children's books around the house through the years. And a lot of children's books, as great as they are kind of passive experiences. You're reading to the child, or the child is reading it, and the book is communicating a story to the child in a passive way. It's just, you know, you're telling a story. Mm-hmm. One thing I love about your books is that the book itself is almost a character. It's almost a third entity. In that it's kind of alive. You are encouraging the child to become involved in the book, and it's a very visceral experience. Is that something that you think about when you're writing?
Oh, definitely. And I think I told you I think about the people that are going to read the book. I'm thinking of myself when I'm going to perform my books, because I'm reading my books to an audience. I listen to the voice. I listen to I'm careful about the gesture. I try to figure out an adult and a child. I try to give the space, the right space for the adult, the right space for the child. The text do not interfere. The text is really below as discreet as possible, mainly because there is a visual experience and there will be a voice that will relate the experience. So yeah, this is definitely what I'm doing. I'm doing unfinished books. I know that when a book is unfinished in my point of view, it's what I want to do. It means that it's unfinished because the reader is going to are going to finish the books by the reading, and all of my books are set that way. There is a book, but it must be an experience. It must be something that is going to happen to you, and you are going to create your own rules, more or less, but your own rules. You take a book, you put the shadows on the wall with your torch. There is no text, or the text is absolutely uninteresting at all, in my opinion. My publisher wanted it. I didn't want any text in that book, Game in the Dark, Game of Shadow. But you've got an experience. You've got the torch. You are in the dark with a child. You are playing with the shadows, and you have to create, to invent, to live that moment together. And maybe that's a part of the success. It's because it's not only my book. It's also your book. So
the idea of the book being unfinished also encourages people to revisit the book and to go through it again and again, instead of it being a the end, and it's, you know, wrapped up nicely.
Mm-hmm.
When you start a new project, do you have an idea of where the book is going to go? What does it begin with? Does it begin with a visual? Does it begin with an action that you're thinking about and guiding someone through? Like, how does it usually start?
So the process is pretty clearly identified now. Maybe I'm always looking for ideas, for sure. I'm looking for ideas, and I put them in a notebook. And sometimes the idea become more and more obsessive. So the idea become more and more precise about something that suddenly become more and more what I'm looking at, what I'm thinking at. So everywhere, I would say, I walk in a museum, I'm thinking of it. Then when it become more precise, I put it in another notebook, but as an intuition. So it means that I'm ready for it. I'm ready to put it in a on a paper. So it's pretty intense, and I put this idea on the book, and I come back some days later. I'm looking at what I've been writing, and sometimes I say, "Oh, it's good." Sometimes I say, "Oh, it's not good," and I'm go back thinking at something else, unless I will have this new improvisation. It's new moment of, let's say, really improvisation, because it's come suddenly. I say, okay, I'm going on it. And sometimes it's almost good. And then I show it to my publisher to make sure. And then I'm doing the drawings in the same way. So I don't want to know how many pages. I don't want to know anything about that. I know that there is an idea, and I want to, I don't know if you say that in English, but to tire it, to make it, you know, to soak it, to go everywhere with it. So I've got ton of materials, and then I tried to create my first montage, my first set of pages. And here becomes a work with my publisher that helped me that give me some advice or his own vision, actually her own vision. And also after I've got my art director since almost the beginning, that is going also to put, to work on the art direction of the book. So at this stage, I'm helped in a way with two people I trust for a very, very long time. But everything is led by intuition and spontaneity.
Right. Do you try out the books on children? Do you have a test market?
Never. That it just each time it's coming out from nowhere, I hope, and it's going to somewhere. I just know now more and more that I know that the people are. Some people follow me, and when I say some, there's a lot because it's translated all over the world. And but I know these people that follow me are going to take over the book. A lot of people are also, now they understand, they discover by themselves, maybe it's helped by the social media because they share their practice, but I know that they are going to invent something with the book. It's happened all the time, and it's a part of my joy because I feel these books so lively by the fact that people put them alive.
Right. Mm. Your books are really communal experiences. They're really meant to be enjoyed by a child and an adult in a lot of cases, and you get this interesting relationship there. When you are talking about the book and marketing the book, because part of your final audience, the children, are not the ones that usually buy books, how do you get the word out about the book, and how do you connect with your audience when part of your audience is not the people that buy the books, if that makes sense?
So I think that I didn't care at all in the beginning. So I mean, I don't care. I mean, I think that I was brought up badly by my first publisher, who was thinking that if you can pay back what you were putting in the book, and if you can be creative, that's enough. So I told you there is no compromise, and I'm doing what I'm doing, and happen what will happen, I don't care. But what I understood, and I didn't understand that with a character which is not translated in the United States. It's not, I don't know why, but it's called Tulu Tutu, and especially this character who was a character who helped me to go to press here after or to blog. But this character, for example, he was completely understood by the children and more than the adults. And it happened to me regularly to have adults coming to me, now less and less, but coming to me, and they were saying, go on, what you are doing is great. But I have to say that at the beginning, I didn't understand what you were doing. So it happened to me regularly, and I know that the adults are a little bit more reluctant to my work than the children. I think more, less and less now, but the children are completely into immediately. The adults, they have to adjust, but I think it's a part of this dialogue because the adults are also surprised by the reaction of the children. The children, maybe they got a power by saying, look at me, how I have fun by reading this book. So maybe there is this kind of energy into the book. And at this point, each reading is different, so I don't know. But yes, there is something that I know that the children are into, and I think because maybe of this visual part, which is completely, totally accessible for the children. They understand it immediately. And maybe they understand it, and maybe it touch the baby side, because I'm obsessed by babies too, to talk to the very little. So, and suddenly, I mean, it's serious because it's ideas and it's, I mean, I hope this is good ideas and so on, but it's look like baby books. So it's relaxing. It's not demanding. It's not saying you are here, you are going to learn how to read. Here, you are going to learn how to behave correctly with your friends or whatever. It's kind of a morality of, I mean, it's important to teach a lot of things. But in my books, there's nothing to learn, apparently. There's a lot to learn, but apparently there's nothing to learn, I think.
Well, your new book is called I Have an Idea. And, you know, I think that the makings of a great children's book is when it looks simple on the outside. And at first glance, it seems like a simple story and a simple, you know, action that you're giving the child. When you know that it's brilliant is when you as an adult start reading it and you're like, oh, this really connected with me mm-hmm. on a deep level. And there's one page specifically in this book that just really connects with me, and I love it. And you said, and right away you know it's good because in every good idea there's always a seed of madness. I love that so much.
So that book, there's something special because it's the first time I talk. I've been doing 80 books, but this one I did it as if it was the last one. So when I said that to my publisher, it was not really happy. But I did it in that way because it was like a legacy. I have been thinking so much about this book for maybe 10 years. I was obsessed by trying to relate my experience with the ideas. And so, yeah, and I have to say that to go back to how books come to me, this idea, I had it for a very, very long time. And when I moved to New York 3 years and a half ago, I took a bunch of notebooks, just like that, a box, a cardboard, card box with notebooks. And inside it, there were this version, because I've been doing a lot of version. And I looked at this version and I was thinking, oh, why I was looking for more think about this idea, because it's already there. So maybe, I don't know when I wrote this one, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I don't know. I don't know where, I don't remember. But when I look at that book, I was thinking, okay, let's start with this, because it was, everything was already set in that notebook.
Well, tell us what the,
hello?
What the, Hervé?
I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. Okay. Sorry about that. So tell us what this book is about. I have an idea. This is like the celebration of where great ideas come from, isn't it?
Yeah. So I had, maybe I had one book in mind, which was also Letter to a Young Poet from Rilke. So I had this feeling that I had to describe my experience, because my experience of having ideas is an experience of the book, but it's also an experience of my life, because I spend a lot of time in schools, in libraries. I set up a lot of projects everywhere in the world, in a deep way. I mean, not just going once in a school to show my books, but staying one day, 1 week, 1 month, 1 year in the same school or in the same classroom. I've been working a lot in underprivileged places, mainly. And I really see this time I was coming as an as a person, and I was sitting and I was saying, so what do we do? And from this dialogue became big stuff everywhere, every time. And what do we do? It becomes this dialogue, and somebody say something, and I say something else, and so on. And suddenly there is this word. And when you've got this word coming in the classroom, when you've got, you know that there is an idea, and you know that everybody understand it. Everybody understand it. And because I am an adult and I'm here to help them to leave something creatively, maybe. And so I'm able to help them to go forward. But when I've got this word, when this word arrive, they are all ready to put their whole energy in it. And I'm here to help them to make sure the idea will come up in a good way. And as they know me, as they know my work, as they know my tools, as they know my scribble, my dots, and my stuff, they are not shy because they know that they will be able to create this idea without technical difficulties. Because they know I'm not a good drawer. They can change the elephant with a dot and three stick to make the legs or whatever. They know that it's not about the drawing. It's more about expressing this idea. And I'm here for that. And as there's so many people now that are working with my books, they are also doing it without me, which is good too.
Right. Well, the book is fantastic, and I see that people are buying this book to give to graduates and people that are starting out in life as adults and going off to college and maybe starting an artistic career. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the book finding a wider audience than just children?
So far, I don't know. I didn't leave that book yet. I mean, books provide experiences, and it's too new. It came out maybe last year in France, but I'm not living in France anymore. And here, it just come up. So I haven't. I haven't an idea, a feeling of that book. I mean, in my real life, it's too short to say that. But during that time, I've been doing. So my book is called "I Have an Idea," and exactly during that time, I created my own idea. So my own idea is the Ideal Exhibition. I don't know if you heard of it.
Yeah.
So this is the experience of that book. It's the Ideal Exhibition. So an exhibition of me, everybody could do without me. So it's come at exactly at the same time. And I have to say that I Have an Idea is express my idea, or the expression of I Have an Idea is the Ideal Exhibition. And I have to say that it's incredibly well received, and it's just amazing. So,
well, the new book is out everywhere now. It's called "I Have an Idea," and this is a fantastic book for just about anyone in your life. Hervé, if people are just learning about you and want to find out more about all the books that you've written and the work that you do, is there a place where they can find you online?
I hope. I mean, I think Google. I think I've got a website. There is a website with the Ideal Exhibition too. I mean, there's a lot of information on the web, and you can look at videos of my performances in museums. They could come in LA in during the summer. There is an Ideal Exhibition at the ICA LA, Institute of Contemporary Art in LA. There's a 1-hour Ideal exhibition in Pittsburgh in early July. And there's a lot online, I think. It's not that complicated. And I always answer to the message when I receive a message, because I'm always in this participative and sharing with people. So, yeah.
It's fantastic. Well, I'll add links to that in the show notes to this episode. Hervé, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Author Stories. Go to hankgarner.com to find all of the archives of the show, and be sure to subscribe while you're there. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
No use crying over spilled milk. Eliza hated that cliche. She'd grown up a cliche, her life a bowl of cherries, duck soup, easy as pie, child's play behind a white picket fence. Mother had been the Wyatt Earp of cliches, firing them off, quick draw. A rotten apple spoils the barrel. Smile and the world smiles with you. Every dog has his day. Children should be seen and not heard. She believed them all, particularly this last. Eliza obliged, preferring to wander the streets of Wytheville, Virginia, on her own lonesome terms. The divorce left Laura a spinster librarian, and one false step on icy stairs left her an invalid as well. The accident happened on New Year's Eve, 1950. Laura had just locked the doors of Wytheville Public Library. We must make black-eyed peas tomorrow, Laura had been thinking, with turnip greens. That ensured a lucky New Year, and if you swept some money over your threshold, a prosperous one, too. She loved those old Southern traditions. She looked both ways, checking for Negroes, but turned a heel on the icy marble of the stairs and fell into the bushes below, breaking the long bones in both legs. Eliza had taken advantage of her mother's absence. She'd lost her virginity that same night. She'd swept Ron Partridge over her threshold, initiating her own beloved tradition. She was nursing a hangover, giddily reliving the event. But around 8:30, she realized that her mother had not come down to breakfast. She checked her mother's bedroom, found it empty, took the bus down to the library, climbed the high stairs, knocked hard on the library doors, and heard a groan below. Laura lay under the William Penn barberry bushes, below the yellow-trimmed windows of the nonfiction section. Her white stockings ran Jezebel red with blood. Sweat and melted snow had soaked her blouse, and her gray forehead blazed. The broken bones didn't kill Laura Merrick. She lay in the hospital, wheezing, her legs mortared up in casts. She had few visitors after the first week. Her church group was glad to fret over a poor thing for a day or two, but they trickled away when Laura had the bad manners to linger. On Valentine's Day, as her mother slept, Eliza drew big, sloppy hearts on her casts. Laura harumphed when she woke and insisted on keeping her legs hidden beneath blankets afterwards. But in late March, something miraculous happened. Laura's self-control dropped. She ranted at nurses, spit at doctors, swore like a Navy pilot dropping F-bombs on Hiroshima. She had dementia, the doctors said. Eliza decided that her mother had just stopped believing her own bullshit. The spells continued over the next 2 weeks, and Eliza enjoyed her mother's company for the first time. They swapped bawdy jokes, ogled the handsome interns, and chattered like best girlfriends late into the evening. They had long conversations, and Laura spoke her own mind in her own words about things that mattered to her. It broke Eliza's heart when the prim, condescending librarian returned. Laura hardly acknowledged anything that had passed between them. The cliches returned. You can't have your cake and eat it too. A leopard doesn't change its spots. Nothing is certain except death and taxes. This last proved true. On April 15th, Laura Merrick marked her Bible with a tongue depressor, set it on her nightstand, leaned back against the headboard, and coughed blood down the front of her nightdress. Eliza found her that way, dead as the proverbial doornail, and yes, the blood was thicker than water, just as her mother had always said. Much thicker than water, in fact, perhaps as thick as molasses in January.